On today's episode of Virtual Sentiments, I talked to Dr. Boris Litvin, a visiting instructor in ancient studies and general education at Eckerd College. Boris and I are friends, and we are political theorists who share research interests that cover both the history of political thought and contemporary politics today. You're going to hear us explain some interesting concepts like audience democracy, spectatorship, and explore the nature of political representation and rhetoric in democratic life. I think the crux of this conversation is that Boris and I have been grappling with the puzzling and disconcerting experience that many of us have had in recent years, which is seeing online culture go from promising this optimistic vision of freedom and democracy to being easily weaponized by illiberal demagogues. Or as Boris puts it, when did online memes go from simply subversive fun to fascism? But don't take my word for it. I'm excited for you to listen and judge for yourself. Today on Virtual Sentiments, we're really lucky to have Dr. Boris Litvin here. He's a visiting instructor in ancient studies and general education at Eckerd College, who works in political theory in topics relating to the history of political thought, as well as contemporary political issues in social media and what political theorists refer to as spectatorship and audience democracy. So welcome to the podcast. Thanks for talking to us today, Boris.
Oh, thanks for having me join. It's an honor to be included in your conversations, Kristen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I'm really excited about our conversation today because I love your work. And also, I guess I'm a little bit biased because we have very similar research interests. So, and I think it's also these research interests of social media, of what's known as spectatorship, of audience democracy. These are topics that I think are both something that you can see as really prevalent in our discourse today and how people just think about politics. I mean, how students think about politics, how, you know, as a political theorist, when you talk to your relatives, they don't always totally get what you do. But if you are talking about things like this, I mean, everybody has an opinion on social media, on memes. And so, you know, it's a way that we can be really engaged in contemporary politics. And they also, though, have purchase with what we normally work on in the history of political thought. So I'm hoping that we'll have a lot to talk about in those topics, kind of triangulating between the sort of what's typically kind of an inside baseball of political theorists and thinking about history, but showing why that type of education is relevant to and can be helpful to conversations that people are having today, both inside and outside the academy. So I was sort of hoping, Boris, if you don't mind, just sort of giving us a little introduction into some of those concepts to make them less technical sounding. I think especially, you know, spectatorship and audience democracy, those are things that roll off the tongue really easily for us, but are maybe not so obvious immediately to people, even within political theory. People who aren't working in those topics aren't always familiar. So yeah, if you could just kind of get us started with those topics.
Oh, for sure. I'd be happy to do that. I think spectatorship, right, it's one of these terms that can sound very abstract and can refer to a number of practices and kind of, you know, invoke a number of different associations. And I think there's kind of an ambiguity built into the term. When I say spectatorship, one thing that might come to mind is something like surveillance, right? So being subject to someone else's gaze. I mean, Kristen, your own research, of course, touches on this, so you're very familiar with this, right? But when you talk about spectatorship as surveillance, or even spectatorship as for example, let's say a politician being subject to like a watchdog organization or something like that, we tend to think of spectating in that case as an activity that exercises power over somebody else. It might shape their behavior, it might shape their conception of themselves, right? So it has some sort of power that it is exercising over someone else, right? On the other hand, you might describe spectatorship in referring to something like a group attribute, like the spectators in contrast to actors somewhere. Right. And in that case, I don't know, imagine picturing like a television host saying, like, for those watching at home, referring to somebody far away, and somebody who or a group of people really who are somehow distanced from the stage, as it were, the proverbial stage. Right. So in those cases, we tend to think of spectatorship as involving marginalization in some sense, right? Being distanced from politics or being distanced from power. When we contrast spectatorship to action, we are describing a disadvantage, right, that we are maybe ascribing to spectatorship. I think just kind of given that ambiguity, that sometimes we're pulled towards describing the exercise of power and sometimes where we're describing disempowerment, there's something kind of interesting at the core of spectatorship. It pulls us in different directions. It's hard to pin down. And I think that ambiguity becomes maybe more of an anxiety, I would say, when you kind of place it in the context of something like audience democracy, right? The broadest sense, audience democracy refers to kind of increasing observations among political scientists, political theorists, that, let's say, our most commonplace experience as members of current day political communities has to do with being spectators, right? So we're not often put in positions of kind of legislative or executive functions, let's say, right? Rarely are we as individuals performing something of, let's say, immediate kind of that communicates immediate agency in our political community. But most of the time, insofar as we're members of a political community, we're sitting back to some extent and watching stuff unfold, right? If that's the case, then it seems like it should really matter whether spectating is an empowering activity or something that's disempowering, right? And it should really matter to us, I think, to figure out what it means maybe for spectators to undergo change, what it means for spectatorship to be capable of changing things in a political community, and how it relates to our kind of basic democratic concepts, the people, accountability, all of those kind of bread and butter questions for political theory.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a great explanation. I really like the way that you put it, that when we're thinking about spectatorship, specifically in the context of these theories of audience democracy itself is kind of a tricky concept because, you know, you can use it in a purely analytical way. So it's just describing the way that our politics functions, especially how Bernard Menon, who originally theorized it, was using it was to almost actually what I found interesting, you might disagree, is that it's sort of a return to 19th century representative politics, because in the 20th century, the rise of party politics and the party machine radically changed the dynamics behind electoral competition. Whereas now, you know, there's the appearance of, or sort of an approximation of, a direct relationship between constituents and their representatives. But, you know, in reality, we know today that that is extremely mediated by the media one way or another. So as Menon puts it, you know, it's the sort of rise of the media expert as an important political player. But it's funny because now, you know, it's been a short amount of time in political theory terms, at least what we're used to in terms of time horizons. But now with social media, it's even more complicated, right? So it's not just that you have in a way, you want to seem less dependent on media and PR experts. And the mediator is really these social media platforms figuring out to kind of how do you get to the targeted audiences that you want to speak to, who are going to be most receptive to your message. And then all sorts of debates there with things like echo chambers, the idea that we are spectators who are separated from each other, who see totally different visions of the world. And that's kind of compounding problems that we're interested in, like misinformation. Yeah. So I wanted to sort of allow us to kind of get into that a little bit, because you and I originally organized a panel for APSA on misinformation, historical perspectives, or perspectives from the history of political thought. And I feel like that was very, you know, in tune with, well, the theme of the conference was misinformation. So that was part of the inspiration. But it's something that, you know, we're thinking about social media and history and political thought. So it felt natural. And we had great panelists on that panel, but we ended up withdrawing in support of the union and the effort in striking. And then also, you know, there were plenty of other issues that weekend. But I guess I figured it'd be good to use this as an opportunity to talk about, you know, why should we, if we're thinking about these ideas that are very new, this idea of now politics is mediated by social media platforms, and why is it worth looking back at history of political thought? What is it that we're doing when we're doing that as political theorists? And kind of how did you see kind of approaching the topic in that way?
That's a great question. And I think that's a crucial question for us as political theorists, right? I mean, I can talk about my particular approach here. Of course, the experience of social media is new. But even if you take a half step back and ask about the experience of more participatory media, that already becomes a little bit less new immediately, right? And my kind of where I enter into the conversation in terms of audience democracy in general is to trace some of those anxieties over spectatorship kind of back through the history of political thought, and to argue kind of in general that the concepts and the vocabulary that we inherit from the texts and authors we treat as canonical are often entangled with these efforts on behalf of those authors to engage popular audiences in new ways. So that's what I mean. We're only taking a half step away from social media when, you know, kind of observing the intellectual contexts across the history of political thought, you see this recurring anxiety over whether popular audiences are paying attention in a meaningful way, whether they're engaging in a meaningful way. And of course, the encounter with the popular audience is like the encounter with a concrete manifestation of collective actors, right? So it becomes this opportunity for a number of thinkers across intellectual history to think concretely about what the people do when they come together, right? And what groups of people do when they come together. My particular focus, so we share a focus on Rousseau in our work. I'm also interested in kind of focus on the works of Machiavelli as well. I think for both of those authors, I mean, you could tell a broader story across the history of political thought from Plato through, I don't know, Hobbes through Arendt, et cetera, right? Like this is a recurring theme. I focus on Rousseau and Machiavelli in particular. They draw my attention in particular because I think in both of their cases, they kind of draw from literary practices that are emerging in their contexts, draw from new literary practices and new ways of engaging audiences, which again resonates with the social media theme, right? That here's a new way for all of us to engage ostensibly, right? It seems to promise something really radically participatory. It seems to at first come with all of this optimism. Then, of course, we see some of that optimism or much of that optimism maybe betrayed in various ways, right? And I think we have something to learn from the history of political thought when we notice that as a pattern, right? That there's an effort to engage audiences in different sort of ways. And in fact, as a result of that, I think some of the concepts that we inherit from the history of political thought, I mean, we could just focus on Rousseau. The general will is a response to Rousseau's engagement with the theater and his criticisms of how normative claims, but generally, like what it means for normative claims to circulate and to address audiences in particular ways, if it happens in the context of the theater, Rousseau is skeptical of the extent to which it can inspire the sort of action that it's representing to its audiences. And he's thinking about how to break out of that theatrical relationship between spectators and actors who are on stage, and spectators who either are being socialized to applaud or are, you know, trying to kind of surmount the stage, trying to react to what's happening on the stage. Rousseau specifically does that, kind of drawing on his experiences and, I think, to put it frankly, his imagination of what festivals are like, what Republican festivals are like, also his experiences with the novel. That's a new genre and a new kind of form of communication, you might say, that's emerging in that context. But kind of broadly, I think, the history of political thought can both offer us examples of what this experience of newness and experience of people coming together in a new way looks like, and how political theory attempts to engage that. And of course, we can also draw concepts that are crucial for our understanding of this stuff. When we talk about representation in the context of social media, for example, we can talk about that in much more detail, but just that term itself, representation, is already entangled with all this other older media that was once new media that shaped our ideas about, you know, what happens when I claim to represent you, or when we are engaged in some relationship that we could call representative.
No, that's great. And actually, I was just thinking about representation because, you know, especially if we use Rousseau as an example of a thinker who is relevant for these conversations and that other democratic theorists have been drawing on. And so one kind of common understanding of Rousseau, or I think, well, what I think should be a very famous claim he makes in Social Contract, is that the English aren't free except for, you know, the brief moment when they elect their representatives, and then that's their sort of brief freedom, just, you know, very kind of, in a way, inflammatory characterization.
That's putting it lightly, yeah.
But it's so funny. I mean, and then I think that can be very striking to us because we take representative politics for granted as kind of our version of democracy. I mean, what democracy is now, and then working within that framing. And of course, people, you know, critique that and are trying to figure out, okay, how do we have a society that's more democratic, knowing the issues that we have in terms of those representative dynamics? And so one example of sort of work on audience democracy from Nadia Urbanati, for example, is the idea of populism, audience democracy being a specific form of democracy and political representation that is sort of conducive to populist dynamics representation, and that populist dynamics are actually very anti-democratic because it's, you know, an individual supplanting, purporting to represent the people, but not doing so and creating that new kind of representative dynamic that's actually, even, you know, if anybody has any complaints about representative democracy now not being democratic enough, it's even less democratic. And so just to tie that back into the Rousseau, though, is I want to kind of ask, you know, so is Rousseau's, do you see kind of Rousseau's politics as being, you know, really anti-representation, and that the issue with the theater is sort of indicative of this broader suspicion of representation in general? Or is it something a little bit more nuanced than that? Is it sort of offering sort of subversion of the way people might think of representation, but then maybe alternative modes of constituting politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a tough question, I think. It speaks to also just the reception history of Rousseau and how he's been interpreted across generations. You go back a couple of generations, Rousseau is read often unambiguously as a theorist of participation, participatory democracy. You know, in the, when the people are assembled, the government is no longer, you know, exerts its authority, right? Because he's making all these claims denoting a skepticism of representation, right? I would say it's more nuanced than that, right? Or I see a host of complications there. Even, I mean, to go back to the context of the theater, when Rousseau is thinking about it, what it means to kind of claw his way out of that relationship between spectators and actors, and that the givenness of that dynamic that's institutionalized by the theater, when he proposes the public festival, it seems like the one of the things he derives from the public festival that to him is so exciting is that it turns the spectators into, as he puts it, that they become the spectacle, right? So it's not that there are no longer spectators, or that that, you know, representative claims no longer exist, but that they are kind of presented in a new way. They're presented in a different way. And so it's almost like you're taking spectators and putting them up on stage, right? So my understanding of the Social Contract is that it's really kind of struggling between these different like directions that Rousseau's thought pulls him in two different directions. But I think he's being pulled on one hand into a direction where he really, really distrusts delegates and the idea of elected representatives as a role that some members of a political community play. And he comes out pretty strongly against that in book three of The Social Contract. But then his underlying ideas about how a group identity comes to form and kind of the story about the formation of the people seems to also involve representation. I mean, you can't say that a lawgiver comes around and makes certain sorts of claims, and then as a result of that, the people build on that, right? And the relationships with one another form as a result of the intervention of a figure who, you know, does something in relation to that. That is describing representation in a sense as well, right? So there's some disagreement in current day scholarship as a result of that about where Rousseau, how Rousseau falls into our kind of contemporary understandings of representation. I mean, I think there's something really valuable to going back to Rousseau for that reason, in that he is, on one hand, so skeptical of some, you know, basic relationships that you can fall into as a result of having a representative system, right? But he's thinking about group identity, nonetheless, in a way that involves representation. It's kind of like a form of self-representation, almost. Like, what would it mean for the people to make claims that they themselves are able to contest and able to respond to in a meaningful way, right? So I think he's not able to fully escape representation, but he sure is thinking about what it means to make representation, you know, something that kind of invites, you know, anyone who about whom something is claimed, like how does it invite them to respond? I think that's an aspect of Rousseau's political thought.
Yeah. No, definitely. I think that those, you put it very well, very complex and difficult reception history and the sort of inherent complexities of Rousseau's thought. Kind of the reason why there's so much contestation and scholarship with thinkers like Rousseau is because the thought is itself genuinely quite complex and has tensions within it. So I think you did a great job with that. I wanted to kind of also talk a little bit about about his arguments on the theater, because it's really striking. So one thing that I'm interested in, and we have a whole other episode on Adam Smith with another scholar, Eric Schlieser. And what's interesting is Rousseau and Smith have been like increasingly paired together in scholarship. People are recovering some of the similarities that maybe were obscured for a long time, partly just as a part of kind of changes in dominant readings of Smith, for example. But one thing that's, I think, very striking that I'm very intrigued by is that they sort of have similar views of the theater, and yet, you know, they depart on their sort of normative criticisms, because Rousseau's, in his letter on the spectacles that you were referring to, where he concludes with these festivals that still have representation, still have spectatorship, but you put it in your article in Review of Politics on Rousseau, is sort of combining observation and action, trying to figure out ways to make that, you know, make there be kind of an active spectatorship, I would say, or action that is ocular in some way. But what Rousseau is criticizing in the theater is that when, you know, the spectator watches, and this is sort of a view of spectatorship, like you put earlier, this idea of the sort of detached spectator, even in a theater, you know, physically proximate, but detached from the stage, in a theater that's detached from the rest of society, a sort of closed space, its own kind of cave.
And Rousseau uses that language explicitly, the Plato's cave, yeah.
Exactly. Explicitly drawing on Plato's cave and the idea of this Platonic kind of critique of appearance versus reality. So part of what Rousseau is saying is that the spectator, you know, they'll watch a play, and even when the play has good moral meaning and messages and stuff, and the spectator is able to judge justly, is able to come to kind of good moral judgments, but they don't do anything about it. They're, you know, they get to pat themselves on the back. I have all the right feelings, I have all the right moral judgments. You know, I'm a good girl, but I don't go out in society when I see that whatever injustice is happening on the stage actually happening. I'm not doing anything to help people. I'm not, you know, helping the person on the street who needs money, who is starving. And that's the real, it displaces action, civic action specifically. And what I think is interesting is that, and part of it is just like they are doing different projects, but Smith's theory of the impartial spectator and the way that he uses theater in his moral philosophy is to really focus on how theater can be morally educative, and not just in a sort of propagandistic way, but that I think that these practices of being detached, of like practicing moral judgment in these more impartial settings, is actually allowing us to kind of train ourselves to be able to judge both ourselves and others more impartially. And so it's sort of it's a predicate for just action, even if it's not, you know, it's admittedly passive, it's admittedly not active, but how can you? And then there's sort of this other, we don't have to get into all that, but there's sort of these other differences about inequality and how they relate, where I think Smith is seeing inequality as shaping the way we judge people, you know, outside of the stage. And that's why our theater is interested in these wealthy kings and tyrants, whereas Rousseau's making these claims of, you know, Geneva is going to be corrupted if we put a theater there, and there's going to be all this admiration for the kings, and you make up the media that we consume.
There's a relationship between those two, yeah.
For sure, yeah. So I'd be interested in your kind of thoughts on that specific idea, those specific details of Rousseau's work on the theater and representation and passivity, passive spectatorship being the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, it really is a messy argument. And I think even mentioning that it's like the letter to D'Alembert is a 100 page work, you know, that's not, it's like the secret treatise to D'Alembert, who was my friend, but really maybe my enemy, right? I think I would say that the way you were framing it, right, that the passive, so I think passivity is half of the story. And actually, perverse form of activity is also the other half of the story for Rousseau, which makes it a messy story, right? So let me attempt to kind of connect the dots. On one hand, I think Rousseau thinks that when there is content in the theater presented to viewers that is presented as virtuous content, like this is the stuff that you should be imitating, this is what you're really like as a good person, etc., right? That content tends to position its audience as a passive spectator, right? So what do you do when you see virtuous content? You're supposed to applaud it, right? You're supposed to respond in a way that shows your recognition. And that's where Rousseau is worried that is habituating its audience less to identify with that content, which he thinks you should already know, right? What is virtuous, or there's already kind of a natural intuition towards what is virtuous. And really what you're being habituated to is identifying with applause specifically, or identifying with being an applauding agent. So he has this parable from Plutarch. Let me try to see if I can recount it correctly in the letter to D'Alembert, where he has this example in ancient Athens, where an old Athenian man is trying to find a seat in the theater, and there's some rowdy, angry teenagers there. Let's say, I might be, you know, exaggerating part of the context, but anyway, these youths who are not very polite, who kind of wave him over, and then they suddenly like close ranks and make it impossible for him to sit down. And then he's kind of like in this very pitiable way, walking around the theater trying to find a seat. And some Spartan ambassadors see this happening, and they immediately move and offer the man a seat, right? And what happens next is very crucial for Rousseau in the parable. The rest of the people attending the theater, the Athenians, they all universally get up and applaud the action that's happened, right? And the old man reflects, saying the Athenians know what is virtuous, but they don't practice it, right? So they've been habituated in such a way that what they just saw happen was not actually part of a play, right? It's something that happens to be taking place in a theater, but it's already, you know, it's already been removed from the stage in such a way that they could be, you know, they could take up the position of enacting something virtuous, but they don't. They recognize it really well, but when they recognize it, what they do is applaud, right? That applause is already a form of action, right? It's not merely, you know, being a non-actor. It's participating, but in a very particular way. That, I think, gets to the second aspect of Rousseau's argument and where it gets messy, that for theater to work, and especially he's talking about comedy in particular, or most of the letter to D'Alembert, for comedy to work, you're also depicting some actions that you're not supposed to identify with, right? You have a villain, or you have action that's being presented as vicious. But Rousseau makes this, kind of develops this the case that for that to work as theater, it needs to be presented in a way that's seductive to the audience, right? If all you saw in theater is here's some virtuous actions, here's some bad actions, you know, act accordingly, that wouldn't be comedy. That would be a sermon, right? And that would be kind of so monumentally boring, right? So, you know, in order for theater to trigger our capacities for judgment, to kind of link it back to Adam Smith, right? I think on the Rousseauian account, it first puts us in certain like subject positions that make that foreclose that judgment, or that certainly habituate us to practice that judgment in ways that he finds corrupting. And then there's a whole story on inequality that links up to that, of course, and where I think Rousseau and Adam Smith, you know, can be and are productively put into conversation on those questions.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting, you know, for Rousseau, there is this larger political economy at play in the letter. It's not just about the theater as representation, but the theater as kind of a commercial institution. And it's sort of, you know, what it will kind of impact on people's spending patterns and their luxury consumption and then status, you know, using consumption to distinguish themselves as status, the sort of spectacle that happens within the theater. You know, that is something that we see in our world, and we take it for granted. And we're, you know, looking back into political thought, the history of political thought, to somebody like Rousseau, kind of allows us to take a step back and question it more thoroughly. So then what are you specifically interested in kind of, and you can feel free to draw on Rousseau or Machiavelli and various parts of your project, but you have a great APSR article on social media and demagogic rhetoric and spectatorship today. And also what I think is very striking too is the sort of idea of memes and the way memes as a genre work online and affect kind of the dynamics of spectatorship and rhetoric online. I think also something that's like that is different about our approaches is that you're very, you know, just really incredibly nuanced and thoughtful work on rhetoric and thinking about like spectatorship and online life and these thinkers as engaging in rhetoric and genre in those ways. Whereas we could say, I'm taking the surveillance approach, I'm a little bit more, you know, thinking of things in visual or ocular exchange terms. But I think these interact very well.
Yeah, no, I think they absolutely interact. And I've learned so much from reading your work. And I think I think the political economy aspect of Lettre de D'Alembert, I think is an aspect of your work, right, that I haven't read. But I'm excited to hear more, though. Yeah. So I'll give a pitch for your future work, right, Krista?
Oh, I think Krista's
future publications involve that question, which is crucial, right? But in terms of the social media context, so that's in kind of my already existing work, that's where I actually am in conversation with audience democracy more directly. In kind of the more contemporary scholarship on audience democracy, there's an insight connected with Jeffrey Green's work that insofar as we are audiences, we tend to benefit or we are in some way empowered when we are not subject to scripted appearances by leaders. That is a strong intuition, I think, that, you know, it's difficult to kind of break out of that intuition. Of course, you don't want to see scripted appearances, right? Who wants to experience themselves being subject to something that you know, is fake, right? But of course, that language, I mean, you know, that language of fake news, right? That language of fakeness as something that has captured audiences, that's also a demagogic strategy or a strategy on particular manifestation of populism, kind of exclusionary populism that makes the case that what you've been watching has all been canned. You're just a spectator in the back row of a theater where you've been disadvantaged, right? You've been marginalized. And if you listen to the leader that makes that claim, that kind of rejection of existing scripts is in itself a rhetorical strategy. That's where I draw on some of that rhetoric stuff that you've been mentioning, or some of the scholarship on rhetoric, rather, right? And to think about how kind of a performance of an intuition that I think all of us have about not wanting to be subjected to scripted performances can itself become a specific sort of strategy for a certain type of leadership or a certain type of approach, a certain type of mobilization as well. Then I turn to social media as an example of thinking about how audiences come to identify with leaders who do this. In general, I think it's quite difficult to talk about social media in a way that doesn't just replicate existing cliches about social media. We tend to either love it or hate it, right? And I tried, although I'm afraid when I revisit this article in whatever number of years, I'll think I'm also replicating some cliches. But I try to kind of not approach it as something that's altogether, you know, the answer to all our problems in democracy, or the worst, the end of democracy, right? Yeah, or like all it is like bots trying to manipulate us or something, right? So how I'm trying to do this is just to think about, there's a kind of a term that's often used in scholarship on social media, affordances, kind of the idea of what sort of interactions, let's say, are incentivized by social media, are made more possible by social media. Of course, that doesn't just apply to social media. It's just used more in this context. You can think of it in context of any genre, right? But I am thinking like, well, what sort of interactions become more likely and more probable and more legible, maybe, as a result of this new participatory form of communication and experience of being a spectator. So I focus on memes as a dominant like genre, you could say, on social media, the idea that the way that you're not just participating more on social media than you do with traditional media, although of course that is the case, but the way that you are encouraged to participate is by modifying already circulating images and modifying them in kind of a snarky way that feels empowering because you're doing something funny and you're doing, you're, I mean, it's fun, right? It's fun to participate in that sort of, in that sort of context. And it's, I think part of this is just kind of me thinking through my own experience of when did fun turn into like fascism, right? What is it that suddenly you take a step back and it's not all fun anymore, right?
Yeah, it's not just lighthearted. It's not just silly, but it has serious political consequences, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It has consequences. And that lightheartedness can sneak in some stuff that's more exclusionary, and that reinforces kind of traditional embodied forms of domination, forms of marginalization, all of that, right? So yeah, I was trying to kind of think through and kind of draw on scholarship outside of political theory and outside of political science that kind of tries to think through how memes create a certain disposition towards the new stuff that you encounter on the internet and the content that circulates on the internet. My focus particularly was irreverence as a dominant kind of form of response, and kind of having this irreverent, kind of embodying this irreverent response to whatever you encounter. That's a way also of shutting down criticism, right? So it's like turning everything into a joke can be a way of policing speech, right? Long story short, my argument is that this enables a kind of easier identification between those sorts of demagogic claims that we were talking about a bit earlier and the sort of thing that audiences are already doing on social media, right? So the demagogue or kind of the exclusionary populist leader can almost like pose as a member of a pissed off audience. And that's a really powerful move, right? As somebody who is trying to establish the legitimacy of your representative claims, if you're able to do that, you're able to achieve something that's otherwise really difficult to do, which is to convince people that your representation of them is something that they should accept, right? That involves otherwise, you know, other rhetorical strategies, techniques, things like that.
Yeah. No, excellent. And I really wanted, I think, so, yeah, something that I'm really drawn to is sort of the connection between the sort of ironic detachment, lightheartedness, and then the notion of authenticity. Because I do think one of the stuff that some of the stuff I was really into, I'm still into it, but just my, you know, dissertation went in a slightly different direction, but then I'm like constantly being brought back, is Charles Taylor's, the Canadian philosopher's work on the ethic of authenticity. And so this idea that, you know, this was sort of a response to claims that, you know, modern society is plagued by moral relativism. And no, there is this sort of overarching concern with authenticity. And now I am really struck by, and especially I think your work, you know, is really sharply articulates this. And also, and it's surprising that I don't, you know, I think we should be all talking about it more, both in academia and outside of academia. This idea that authenticity is can be a performance. It can be something that it engages in a certain context. It bounces off of certain ideas. It just requires this sort of declamation of, you know, departing from challenging, you know, whatever dominant established ideas are. This idea of kind of the way that fake news, you know, became like a sort of Trump's own term and insult, right? Like he appropriated that. just really, it's almost like, you know, this is, you know, because of my work, I always think of Foucault's visibility as a trap, but it's authenticity is a trap. That's the trap that we're in now, because I'm also, Christoph Pelk writes about this in his book, and this idea that to be authentic, you can choose to incur costs of lying. If you're willing to lie in public like this, you know, there's something trustworthy about you because of what you're willing to bear for your team or, you know, the people who support you. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I was interested in sort of what's your thinking on authenticity as sort of a broader cultural ideal that we're working with, and how do we kind of deal with the fact that you can see canned or authenticity as being performed and being, you know, actually indicative of falsehood or deceit?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. That's a tough question. It's an important one. I think that it's very difficult to abandon authenticity as an ideal. And I guess I'm interested in at least problematizing what we take to be authenticity, right? Or maybe at least denaturalizing what authenticity looks like. If you wanna think about the significance of the history of political thought to that conversation, one of your best bets is going to be Rousseau, or Simon Rousseau, Mary Wollstonecraft, the others as well, right? But I think Rousseau is so central to that as somebody who's thinking about how authenticity is performed as well. I think authenticity serves as a marker of legitimacy, especially when it comes to context involving representation, right? Because somebody's making a claim in a representative relationship about what someone else is like, right? And about what someone else's interests are like, right? And being able to communicate authenticity in the course of that claim-making practice is absolutely crucial. Insofar as authenticity is always situated in other cultural practices and performances, I think it's incumbent on us at least to question where those come from, right? I'm not sure that we can get rid of authenticity or what it looks like to get rid of authenticity once and for all, but it is a trap, right? And insofar as it's a trap, we need to think about how we get kind of, how we pigeonhole particular performances of authenticity.
Yeah. And I think you put it very well. And I think that it almost proves just how powerful authenticity is in our society because of the sort of ways that people go about striking poses to perform it, you know, and the idea of, yeah. So I think that that's sort of, I don't think we can necessarily get rid of it, but it also means that when we are shocked, you know, one group of people is shocked by the lies of a demagogue and that, you know, it works for their supporters, it sort of is indicating just sort of how much.
Oh, those lies are authentic, right? That's the problematic crux of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it doesn't, it's not that, it's similar to what you were saying about social media, where the challenge of every time, you know, I think we, and what you were saying earlier about Rousseau and history of political thought and people getting excited about new technologies or new genres and new forms of communication, or really just anything kind of new, you know, can be, you feel optimistic, and then you start realizing all the insufficiencies, all the inadequacies, all the sort of problems that you thought maybe could be solved by it, but are actually kind of, you know, more broader structural system-wide political issues that don't get cured by it. And not to, because the other thing that I think is what stood out to me about your work in the APSR about this was, I'm talking about Black Lives Matter and sort of this idea of the active bystander spectator as like turning, making a gaze into an event. And, you know, and I think what is also good is that there are some people who think if we just broadcast, if we just show how the world, how horrible, all these horrible things in the world, like that will bring about good change. And, you know, having to deal with the, what can feel tragic and can be upsetting, which is that even people can see And still the change doesn't come in that, you know, throughout history, it's political organization efforts that people working hard together collaboratively toward social change, institutional changes that are important. But that's something that you can't capture in technology. But at the same time, we do have to think about, you know, how does technology fit into it, and how do individual actions, how can we study that to understand how people orient themselves and how democratic life can be a mode for positive change too. So yeah, we see gradations of Rousseau and that sort of like passive spectatorship.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like once again, we're back to Rousseau. And I think we're back to where we maybe started our conversation with spectatorship, possibly evoking our ideas about surveillance, or spectatorship evoking our ideas about group identity, right? And sometimes I think there's this tendency to think that just the opening up surveillance to a greater number of people can serve as a check on power, right? So in my APSR article, I kind of compare and contrast body cams in the context of policing versus filming the police, right? Two examples of subjecting agents of the state to spectatorship, but two different ones, right? I think one of which involves kind of this constant all-seeing gaze, but one that is not connected to forms of organization, as you were suggesting, Kristen, right? One that's not rooted in some spectator's action per se, or some group of spectators' actions, right? And the other, which is filming police, that's a very episodic practice, right? If you don't show up and turn on a camera, it doesn't happen, right? But on the other hand, it seems to convey a different relationship to power, and it tends to upset police a lot more, right? Because it's much more in your face as a practice, right? And it makes that gaze that's being directed something that's much more active in a way, or active in a different sense than it would be as a, you know, just a camera that's ever present. I think that again connects back to our conversation about social media. There is this, I think, uncomfortable dynamic with social media where it's so participatory on one hand, and it's so the conversation that happens feels like it's an infinite conversation. But as a result of that, what I think you risk masking in socially mediated spaces is what it means for audiences to come together, what it means for people to come together as an audience. It's like as somebody participating on social media, I think you have the sense of always being kind of like you've arrived at a conversation after it started and you have to leave before it ends, right? You're always there just for a blip of a longer conversation. And while that speaks to the ubiquity of that conversation, to the fact that it's become so broad and it includes way more voices, what's become obscured in that phenomenon is an event where people come together and can say, we came together, right? That often becomes obscured, I think, on social media.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, really great way to put it. And so what are you kind of excited about in terms of your future work and what you're working on now?
That's a great question. I'm let's say slowly cobbling together a book project, right? So a lot of the things we've been discussing, there is a broader narrative that I'm working on, and you know, I have publications that delve squarely into the history of political thought and others that delve into contemporary politics. The challenge is to bring those two conversations together, which we've attempted to do right now in our conversation, but getting that on paper can be a little bit tough, right? So, I mean, I'm excited, of course, to bring this book project together. And I'm also, in general, kind of working on a broader approach that tries to put these kind of turns to different genres or uses of different genres as kind of a recurring theme in the history of political thought, even if it doesn't fit into a particular conversation about spectator empowerment, representation, voking the people, all of that. But I think you see these sorts of moves across intellectual history. I'm working on a piece on how Hannah Arendt does that in relation to biographical narratives. I think some of her biographies tend to be a little like Men in Dark Times, her collections of biographies tend to be a little bit overlooked, or they're used in very particular ways. Like, here's a claim that she makes in one of her biographical essays, we can use that. But kind of approaching a work more generally as making a biographical intervention that I think could use a little bit more attention. And that sort of problem, I think, kind of presents itself across the history of political thought. Like why is it that a particular thinker finds it incumbent to turn to a different genre? And especially for kind of contemporary political theorists, we tend to be, we're kind of stuck in one genre for the most part, with the exception of you who develops podcasts, right?
Well, I'm very lucky to have the kind of position that incentivizes that, I guess, or at least doesn't disincentivize it.
No, and it really is great, and it's really valuable, right? But more broadly put, though, we are generally incentivized to write in one particular kind of set of genre conventions. And I think one of the effects of that is to be more attentive to cases in the history of political thought where the stuff we do is mirrored by the stuff someone else did, right? And I hope we don't miss the stuff that's different.
Yeah, no, and I love that. And I think it is both important for understanding history. History has value in its own, and understanding these different texts and intellectual resources have on their own merits. But then also it is instructive for thinking about taking us out of what we take for granted, and then also, you know, seeing what is so central to our lives in kind of a different light. I was also really struck by, and I think you were drawing on other work on this, but this idea of memes as a folkloric expression. That's very fascinating. Would you mind just explaining that a little bit?
Yes. So let me remember the authors. That's Phillips and Milner, I believe. Don't ask me the first names because they're not at the forefront of my mind, but I do encourage folks to find their book. I believe it's called The Ambivalent Internet. It is, I think it's a great primer on this stuff, right? But their approach specifically is to see what memes are doing as kind of part of a broader pattern of kind of folkloric, meaning like popular and not official, ways of kind of taking the you know, existing forms of art or existing artifacts and modifying them, like messing with them in some way, and then circulating that. So they look at, oh, things like, I don't know, office memos and like funny things added to office memos, for example, or maybe you can think of like things like graffiti as kind of precursors to what memes are doing. What I think is unique about memes and what makes them politically unique and interesting is that here you have a online kind of digital space where that sort of communication, which is normally subversive, which normally flies under the radar, it's like a weapon of the weak kind of in terms of James Scott's ideas, right? And then on the internet, it becomes a dominant form of communication, right? And as a result of that, its implications for what it does to how we communicate, you know, that undergoes change, right? And then that becomes, again, it becomes a way of policing speech in I think, an unexpected and a maybe disappointing way.
Yeah. No, that's excellent. No, thank you. Because I thought it was such a striking, and it really also goes to show how important interdisciplinary engagement is too with and you know, how much political theorists can learn from. I don't remember. Are they media studies scholars? It sounds like a media studies project, so.
It's mostly media studies scholars, right? And I went looking for, you know, like, I want to know more about memes, which I personally experience and have many thoughts about. But, you know, it seems like we all have thoughts, but right, and immediate impressions. But I had not known much in terms of scholarship on this before I started working on this project. Yeah, and absolutely crucial, I think, for my conclusions and for my approach to kind of social media demagogy question. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's excellent. No, and I think we see all this audience democracy, that sort of pathological or sort of disturbing tie in between sort of the lighthearted, the silly, and the sort of dark and anti-democratic. You know, that was something people were talking a lot about with the attack on the Capitol building in January 6th, too, and the sort of live streaming and the way people were dressed up. And, you know, just because there is this sort of, you know, ironically detached, silly internet culture doesn't mean it can't have, you know, anti-democratic and sort of major force and implication. And so I think that interdisciplinary, you know, these are puzzling, you know, difficult events. And so, you know, being able to draw on and having conversations across disciplinary boundaries is, I think, so central. And I love one of the things I love about political theory, to not to be then be all like, oh, I love my discipline, is that I think we have the freedom to do that. I don't think every subfield of political science or every discipline is as sort of open to and flexible with those types of engagements. And I think that that's something we can continue to draw on. So thank you so much. Is there anything else we didn't get to talk about that you were hoping to share?
Nothing comes to mind immediately, but I really appreciate our conversation. I think your framing of it has really, you know, I've learned a lot just from listening to you, you know, bounce things off of what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know. We should have it. We should have more conversations not being recorded too.
Yeah, well, maybe an APSA panel would be nice. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would be good. Okay, awesome. Yeah, no, well, I'm really excited for more conversations. And thank you so much again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
There's a quote from Jean-Jacques Rousseau's letter to D'Alembert that we discussed in this episode that I'm always thinking about whenever I'm thinking about the history of political thought and social media today. As Rousseau writes, "It is only reason that is good for nothing on the stage. A man without passions or who always mastered them cannot attract anyone. Does this remind you of anyone or anything that we've experienced in recent years?" Rousseau wasn't thinking about social media or audience democracy, but I think he's a very relevant thinker for these conversations. As Boris said, he was thinking deeply about how to engage the public, how politics and the theater intertwine. So first, I want to clarify some of the technical concepts that we talked about in this conversation. So first, Boris and I both work on audience democracy, and this is a descriptive concept. So it's not necessarily an ideal we are aiming to work towards, but a framework for thinking about politics today. And it's a concept that helps us get a handle on these very unique aspects of our politics. So it was coined by Bernard Menon, and he meant for it to evoke a theatrical divide between the representatives and politicians who actually legislate, hold, and exercise political power, who act on that public stage, versus the people who vote and also have other forms of political participation, but are mostly experiencing politics as spectators, watching it unfold, less able to influence what goes on the public stage. So it's very different from those who use other concepts of ideal forms of democracy, such as kind of measuring our politics against this ideal of the way that we deliberate and argue and reason out together, like in a discussion seminar, let's say. And rather, the concept helps us focus on what might not be ideal about our politics and to see how politics is shaped by experiences like spectatorship. As we talked about in our episode, the term spectatorship can be used in multiple ways, and it has tensions within it, a kind of duality. So on the one hand, it evokes a passive form of watching, that idea of the fact that we, the people, may experience life as spectators of politics, distanced in some way, marginalized in some way, not really the actors on the public stage, but just watching them. But at the same time, spectatorship is very much a form of surveillance, too. It can be people watching others, and that experience of being watched may shape the behavior of those on the public stage. But this is, I think, a very slippery and complicated concept, and something that we were able to talk about a little bit in our last episode with Chris, the idea that surveillance has been used historically by the state against people, both abroad in occupied places and at home in the American case, but in other cases as well. And some people, though, use audience democracy to think through new forms of ideals. So Jeffrey Green's work is arguing for the idea that the people may not affect politics so directly. We may not have that much of a voice or a will collectively in our politics, but we have the people's gaze. And the politicians can be exposed to our gaze in different ways. They can be forced to do things in an unscripted manner to expose themselves in this revealing, candid way. Green specifically uses this idea of having an ideal of candor that we should seek to implement in our society. But Boris's work really helps us think deeply and critically about the notion of candor and the fact that authenticity, being candid, is socially embedded, that it is shaped by social media, shaped by our interactions, and can end up being a tool for demagogues rather than empowering individuals as members of the democratic people. And so Boris highlights specifically the notion that we're trying to get at in all these conversations, which is that social media is not going to be this technical solution to all of our politics, but it also isn't necessarily to blame for everything that we are frustrated with and worried about today. But rather, Boris uses the concept of affordances, which we talked about in our last season in episodes with Jennifer Forrestal and Maren Gurry talking about social media. And affordances refer to the specific design features of social media platforms that enable, encourage, or discourage, or prevent, make it much harder to have certain forms of speech and interactions. Boris highlights in particular the idea that irreverent discourse is so rewarded online, that we engage in this irreverent discourse and making things kind of silly, lighthearted, having jokes through memes, but that this irreverence can also be a form of policing speech. It can help advantage those who want to simply pose themselves as authentic alternatives to the scripted, canned establishment politicians. This doesn't necessarily mean that we should do away with expecting or hoping for individuals in politics who are candid, who are authentic, that we feel we can trust, but it does complicate and problematize what we assume is authentic, how we expect authenticity to be perceived and rewarded. It helps us understand how the problem is not just something like echo chambers where all of us are seeing different visions of reality, but rather that when we all are exposed to the same rhetoric, the same politician, one group of people can be turned off by that politician. They can see them as fake, as an obvious liar, as grossly untrustworthy, whereas other spectators can look at that politician and feel, finally, here is someone who I feel I can trust, who's not just repeating the same old fake scripts, but is somebody who I think will stand up for me. Finally, this conversation really dovetailed nicely with our last episode with Chris Coyne on surveillance, because not only were we talking about social media, but we were talking about ways that the people use social media to watch the watchers, to push back against state surveillance. And this is specifically in the case of Black Lives Matter and the use of bystanders' videos of police brutality. Now, there's been a big movement to push for body cams of police as a solution to these problems, and yet we should think critically about that. Body cams still put observation, put video in the advantage of the state. We wouldn't want a state monopoly on the way that we perceive police power. And also, we should be aware that video is not an object that is objective. It is something that is subject to interpretation, that can be used just as easily, unfortunately, to justify power rather than counteract it, rather than being a tool of accountability. And Boris highlights how the way activists and ordinary people are able to use video to put pressure on the police and also subject the police to public scrutiny in ways that, again, chip away at the state's monopoly on power, on visions of power, on the way that we understand our democracy and how it functions. Boris's work, and I hope this conversation, really highlights how spectatorship is complicated and that it is, in terms of thinking about how it can work in favor of the people, in favor of democracy and our freedoms, it requires being paired with action, having an active element to it, of being connected with participation, mobilization, and institutional changes. I'm really grateful to Boris for taking the time to talk with us and participating in that long tradition of scholars speaking to the public. And I'm grateful for you for joining us. Thanks for listening. Till next time.